Hi, welcome to the Pocket Contemplative. I'm Jason Meltzer. And if you're listening to this near the time it comes out, happy Holy Week. In the last episode, we started talking about what might be the most concrete and widely used ancient contemplative practice, the Jesuit practice called the Examen, which pushes us to be in touch with how we're actually doing, with what actually brings us life, and conversely, what drains life from us. And we talked about why that has been regarded as such a useful spiritual thing to do, rather than just as some form of self-help. Today, we're going to push further into that kind of self-understanding as a key part of our hoped-for road to union with God, as we think more about what it means to know what's true for us, and then, maybe harder still, to let that truth be seen, sometimes in settings where it's out of the mainstream of our friends or even our families, as if increasingly knowing who we actually are and then being seen for our actual selves is more important to your and my spiritual development than we might think, but it can feel intense, to be sure. The great mystics are really into this. But it can seem odd if we've spent time in churches or other houses of worship, because we learn truths there, of course, and they aren't our truths, but in principle, they're eternal truths. On the upside, we can learn some important things that people have taught about God for a long time. But on the downside, maybe we find we have hidden parts of ourselves that might not be welcome under the umbrella of those big truths, and that might make us feel threatened or on the outside or just less and less in touch with what's important to us. I'll start us off with an affecting and dramatic story that's going bad for someone, and then pushing further into the sorts of insights the Examen offers us, I'll look at something that might give real insight into the power of this, at two different approaches to living out our truth, by way of looking again at the stages of faith that are sometimes called the critical journey, that itself got its own episode of this podcast a few months back. I'll tell a story about how this has usefully played itself out for me, but I'll also explore the challenging reality that many great saints, not least Jesus and St. Paul, have been widely shunned by their important circles because of their insistence on knowing and living and being seen for their actual truths. And I'll close with some suggestions about how to live this out, whatever happens, throughout our lives. Before we get started, if you'd enjoy exploring weekly online small groups that focus on the spirituality we talk about here for people in America and beyond, you can get all the information about those groups, along with much more, at journey-on.net, journey-on.net. Okay, let's get rolling with Be Seen. Occasionally I get calls from people who have read my book, Blue Ocean Faith. It's a book about how churches might understand themselves in an unexpected way in kind of a changing world. The people who call me usually found the book during a transition in their faith experience, and they want to tell me their story and maybe get some advice, not realizing I don't have a lot of advice. So a while back, I had a conversation along those lines. I will change a few details just for the privacy of the person, but I think we'll get the spirit of it. So a woman called me who had grown up her whole life in a conservative Christian church and network of churches in the Midwest. And she had just had a traumatic experience. She had let slip to a friend of hers, also in the church, that she was questioning one of the key doctrinal elements of the church, that women should never speak in churches. And her friend, fearing for her own eternal soul, I think, passed on the comment that the woman talking to me had made about this concern to the pastor. The pastor got in touch with the woman, chewed her out, and then decided to excommunicate her from the church because she was now a wolf who was going to eat sheep because of her heretical opinions. And so the church asked all the friends in the church, whom this woman had grown up with, her whole social circle, to shun her and her family because of her heresy, which they did. In fact, the woman said to me that the pastor then remembered there was one person whom he hadn't contacted directly about this, a family member and their family. So he then did contact the family member and her family, who then did indeed shun my friend or my new conversation partner. And her comment was, what's my hope? What does this mean? And so it was in that time of crisis that she stumbled across my book and felt seen and felt like the book gave her permission to kind of explore a new way of thinking about faith. That was helpful, but didn't know maybe could she just find a community like this right away. And of course, we have online groups, but that wasn't quite where she was at. Anyway, you can feel the pathos of that story, right? And the challenge of that story. And I'll mention a few things we talked about and a few other kind of things to think about a story like that as we go. But I'll just use that as a backdrop for what I wanted to talk about today. Now, I've had challenging moments along those lines myself. That was not new to me, those sorts of stories, even in my own personal story. I mean, I think about the meeting of people in my wife's in my previous church who gathered to talk about my heresy for not condemning gay people more than I did. And they invited Grace to come to that meeting because they thought she would be sympathetic and might talk me out of my heresy or perhaps leave me. You can imagine that was kind of an interesting night where Grace comes home that night. I'm like, hey, Grace, how's it going? What have you been up to tonight? That was quite a story. Anyway, and of course, there's more where that came from, and not just from conservative religious communities. I have some from progressive religious communities as well, where just being who you actually are is not welcome. Now, in the last episode, we talked about how the road to union with God begins with a kind of integrity, and how a scripture along those lines is the curious one of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, commanding us to be perfect as his Father is perfect. Now, what I took about that being about integrity is that Jesus's Father, God, does not have to say lie, because the truth will always be in perfect line, a lineup with the integrity, with the walls of like the building of God the Father, that they're set on a good foundation. They're not going to crumble. They, you know, the wind can go through the windows. There's no problem. And so being honest and transparent about who God the Father is part of the Father's character. But that's the thing that can crumble the integrity is a kind of lying, as we'll talk about even theologically in a minute. And as my conversation partner discovered, telling the truth can have serious consequences if our understanding of truth or our wondering about truth or our evolving sense of truth or our own personal truths quit matching that of our friends or our family or our culture. But maybe there's an important thing going on here so that our own integrity doesn't start to collapse. So we don't have to close off parts of the house, you know, in this metaphor that's inside of us that other people can't see, that wouldn't be an integrity either. Maybe telling the truth and living a truth has more power to it than we give credit to. Now, you might wonder, though, does our truth, our internal truth, matter at all if it doesn't line up with the teachings of our group? You know, those are bigger truths than just our inner truths. And doesn't, for just one example, the Bible have a whole lot of truths which matter a whole lot more than whatever you or I might throw into the mix? And again, maybe if we foolishly let people in on certain of our truths, we might have to start over, as the woman I talked with is having to do, and as Grace and I have done on occasion. And that can seem like a pretty devastating loss. But when we give it a moment's thought, we remember that both Jesus and Paul had to do exactly this, and for exactly these reasons, and that must teach us something. So you might remember that Jesus had an intervention staged by his mother and other family members, you know, his mother who's treated quite well in places of the Bible, but here was standing against Jesus, calling him demon-possessed and wanted him to come home and abandon that crazy stuff he was teaching, which of course he refused to do. Or Paul, who wrote 2/3 of the New Testament, Paul had to leave behind everyone he'd ever known at fear of being murdered because of his evolving understanding of who God was. And that became so threatening to the group, they drove him out kind of at gunpoint. And you would think that sort of like the woman who was calling me, that maybe Paul then just could quickly say, oh, well, I lost that group, but I'll go to this new group, the apostles, and they'll have new friends, and that's just the way it goes. That didn't happen for Paul. We're told it took him decades of being by himself until he found his way into the life with the apostles, which had its own stresses on its system. But nonetheless, he ultimately found his peeps, but it took a while. And then, as we're reminded during Holy Week, Jesus, of course, stepped this up a notch further, sticking to his uncomfortable truths all the way to getting himself tortured to death by what at one point appeared to be his own religious community. So it seems like we've stumbled upon an intense but pretty central spiritual truth here, and at this time of the church calendar, it's really relevant. So in that spirit, the mystics teach us that continually discovering and owning what we actually know is a key part of our hope for continuing our journey towards ever greater closeness with God. I wonder if a grid we looked at a few episodes back might help us get to the heart of what's at stake here. It was a popular take on stages of faith that, for instance, my wife is currently being taught in her spiritual direction program. It was developed by a former teacher at the theological seminary I attended, the late Robert Gulick, and his colleague Janet Hagberg. They wrote it down in a book called The Critical Journey, Stages in the Life of Faith. And I wonder if it might help us unpack how to think about the pressures we might feel in our religious or cultural community to pipe down about any truths which are not pre-approved, however much they might seem important to us. and about how to think about what I think is a God-empowered understanding of why those truths are so important for us, both to get in touch with and ultimately not to hide. Let me give you a very brief tour of their stages, which, as I mentioned in the earlier podcast, are different than the other stages I've occasionally written about and mentioned on this podcast. These stages that we're talking about here, we're going to call the critical journey stages. All right, stage one in the critical journey, they call the recognition of God. Stage one is the recognition of God. This might be similar to what I've called the first naivete on earlier podcasts, if that rings a bell, but it's where we've made this great discovery in our lives that God turns out to be both real and powerful, and that seems like great news. It's the first flush of excitement that God could be important and meaningful in our lives. So in this first stage, the recognition of God, we believe our lives are amazingly orchestrated by this good God. Where has this been all our lives? It's like King David in the Bible wondering why no one is taking on Goliath. And he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? He's full of his oats because this God is so good, as he's just discovering. Stage one. Stage two, they call the life of discipleship. The life of discipleship. So this is where we find a great group of people who believe the stuff we've just discovered in stage one. This group can teach us the ropes. We need to be led and taught in what some Christian circles call discipled. We feel like we've found our kind of people. And perhaps this is like the role Israel plays in the Old Testament as being the people of God. It's their peeps. They've got a group now. I mentioned in the earlier podcast, remembering how people at conferences at the denomination I was in at the time like to talk about having found their tribe with a denomination. Stage two. And this isn't just a conservative thing. Hagberg and Gulick tell us that the organizing principle for a stage two group might be like the cause, like hunger relief or wellness or racial and LGBTQ justice. At this stage, people often see the cause or leader as the answer to what they've been looking for. And there's comfort at this stage, knowing that we personally don't have to figure out the answers and someone else can help us with them. There are answers out there to be found, and this group's going to tell us what they are. Stage three, they call the productive life. In this stage, who we are becomes useful for God. People look up to us as we help them with their faith journey. My wife says, when we were leading the church in Cambridge, we and some of our friends there were totally in this third stage in our own way because things were kind of cooking. Who we were really mattered, you know, in this group. Stage three, the productive life. But then things all begin to turn with the fourth stage, which they call the journey inward. So here it all crashes. This group, which has gone so great and we found ourselves productively a part of, it all sort of collapses, as perhaps it did for my conversation partner. And I'm guessing here, perhaps it has for many people who listen to a podcast like this one. So this move from that third stage to the fourth one is most likely kicked off by a crisis in our life or our faith, which makes many of our former truths and answers inadequate or unhelpful for the next phase of our journey. And the journey at this point can be super personal and difficult to share with others, which makes it really hard to develop any sense of belonging. So it's St. Paul, he's been kicked out of his one community and he hasn't found a new one. He's just on his own. That sounds like classic journey inward. Or it's like Jesus's friend Peter. So the Peter who emerged after Easter to lead the church after Pentecost was a different Peter from the man who felt disgraced after denying Jesus. In between was this big crash. Though clearly, you know, there was more to the story for Peter, which might tie into our fifth stage, which we'll get to in a minute. Or again, I'm just using a million biblical examples about this crash moment. It's like Elijah in the Old Testament, who went from being God's great representative on earth to fleeing for his life and wondering what on earth just happened. Some people call this stage the dark night of the soul. It's a time of feeling withered and alone, of searching and not finding, of grieving, of feeling loss. Stage four. However, you can kind of emerge. The good news is it's on this stages of faith understanding, there's good stuff in front of this, that we have to go through this to get the good stuff. And the next stage, stage five, they call the journey outward. The previous one, the journey inward, is sort of the starting of the soul. The journey outward. This would be the post-Pentecost Peter. He's gone through it, and now his whole life is in front of him, and he understands himself in a very new way. We've come through this wall, this starting of the soul. And we realize we can be useful to others in a different way than we were in stage three, this productive life stage. We come to realize that God's purpose corresponds with our deeper truths, who we actually are at core, our longing, our purpose. We weren't even aware of those things until we went through stage four. What's true for us? And that matters for God's purposes, we discover in this fifth stage. It was there all along. We begin to experience God's choices for us as our calling. We're not in charge. We don't do the planning. We live out of who we actually are, our center. We become natural healers. And we're clear about our calling again. We have to let go of our anger and grief over past wounds. All right, to foreshadow, as you probably picked up, I'm going to pitch that the heart of our dilemma about how to discover and then pass on our internal truth boils down to how truth functions differently in stage two, this life of discipleship where there's this community, and how it functions in stage five, where we suddenly discover who we actually are and how that fits in with what God is doing in the world and in us. Those are two different ways of seeing truth, as we'll talk about in a minute. But meanwhile, there's a sixth stage. Let me just get to that. The sixth stage, they call the life of love, the life of love. I wonder if this corresponds to what sometimes we've called flow here, using psychological terms, but we're also calling union with God. We're now totally connected with who God is. We're pretty much like a saint. Here we find that we actually seem to trust God rather than like working to trust God as we did in previous stages. We find we define ourselves less than we did even in stage five. This stage represents not, Gulick and Hagberg tell us, not our work, our calling, our life, but it's something beyond us. It's the life we live in God. It's about a transcendent life beyond ourselves. And so people on this stage are going to be uninterested in things like personality profiles or tests to discover their gifts. And that's not because they're not self-reflective. It's because they know themselves really well now. They see and own their truths in the way we're talking about here. And so they're not interested in being validated or recognized. Okay, I'll come back to that. But all that said, let's think about how this helps us understand with our future selves in stage six, why it might be such an important and godly choice to ever increasingly get in touch with the truths we know, even if they're just our truths. You might see how the examine, which we talked about in the last episode, might be so valuable here. So the examine, you'll remember, involves perhaps a daily ritual where you, with God, ask what most brought you life in the previous day. You identify this thing they call your consolation, what most brought you life. You invite God to help you identify what's the one thing that was most life-giving. And then you ask God to help you identify what least brought you life the previous day, what they call your desolation. So the exam is all about identifying your consolation and your desolation. And if you want to hear more, again, the previous episode gives about 20 minutes on this, so a little bit more. The theory seems to be that this is going to help you see who you actually are, rather than just seeing your life as living out the roles your life has assigned you, and that this information might help you understand how God is guiding you. So in the Critical Journey's view of the world, I wonder if, to at least some degree, we settle into this groupy stage two life of discipleship stage, where we find our friends and the leaders who are going to help teach us the ropes of faith. We do it because we want stability. We want something good and unchanging so that we know things are going to be all right for us no matter what happens in our uncertain future. And I think that's why others are in the group with us as well. They also want that comfort and stability of knowing, here are the teachings that are going to keep me safe from the vicissitudes, the battering of where life could take me. And it's these people and these truths, I'm not going to have to suffer in that way. But that it comes with an implicit promise not to rock the boat, because if somebody rocks the boat with different sets of truths, it all could blow up, and then we're all at risk. But the fact is that things are going to change. And it turns out there isn't any hedge against hard times and confusions. It's a falsehood that's at the core of the second stage. And the second stage lacks the flexibility to roll with those changes. And of course, again, it has a falsehood at the core that things aren't going to change. So the critical journey stage five, the journey outward, after we've gone through this crash, this dark night of the soul, it has this needed flexibility along with the wisdom that we've gained by having gone through and beyond the harrowing stage four. And so it by definition encourages us to live out of our actual truth, the truth that will become our baseline should we ever wander into their final transcendent saint-like stage six. These stages rely on us knowing and living out who we actually are. This is where we learn maybe for the first time or maybe in an entirely new way that, as Jesus teaches us in John chapter 8, the truth will set us free. So stage two has this constant threat hanging over its members. Don't rock the boat or you'll lose all your friends. But to actually grow into healthy, adaptive, generative spirituality, of course you will have to leave the stability and comforts of stage two. Again, Jesus and Paul did. If there's a pressing truth that maybe right now you're hesitating to let people in your circle know, maybe it's a sign that this transition has become imminent for you. To my mind, God has dropped us hints in each stage that this transition is coming. So in stage two, you might sing songs like the mid-20th century hymn, "I Have Decided to Follow Jesus." I have decided to follow Jesus, it says. No turning back, no turning back. Though none go with me, still I will follow. No turning back, no turning back. In stage two, as we sing it, I think the point of the hymn is to bolster us as Christians leaving behind our non-Christian ways and our non-Christian friends. We're not going to backslide. You know, they aren't going to suck us back into the old ways. But I think the song works great for people leaving this second stage as well. Out of obedience to Jesus, even if our truth gets us ejected from the group, though none go with me, still I will follow. So if you'll forgive me a brief Bible digression that perhaps offers us some helpful advice on how to keep our walls from collapsing during this challenging transition, one charming aspect of Mark's gospel is that it directly talks about the things that are most likely to ruin our hopes for integrity along these lines. It's got a big three of threats to being able to continue on the critical journey. What will choke it out? And some scholars have summarized the big three this way. Threat number one, Satan and demons. Pretty blunt, all over Mark. Satan, the devil, and demons, they're going to keep you from moving forward. And I think there's a pretty powerful interpretation of what that means on the terms of what we're talking about here, which I'll get to in a minute. Threat number two, unforgiveness. So hence, John the Baptist shows up at the very beginning of Mark's gospel with a baptism for the forgiveness of sins. And that's where Jesus joins the story. We don't hear about his earlier life. He is just this guy who shows up right at that point of the story, not because he needs forgiveness, but because he's all about forgiveness. And so there we go. Threat number one, Satan and demons. Threat number two in Mark, unforgiveness. And threat number three to being able to continue on the critical journey is, of all things, a desire for riches, a desire for riches. That's in the story of the sower and the soils in Mark chapter four. Threat number one, Satan. Threat number two, unforgiveness. Threat number three, a desire for riches. So why those three things? Well, let's look at unforgiveness. Let's say we're stuck in an old story of how we've been wronged, as perhaps the woman I spoke with struggled with because she had been wronged. You know, all her friends and family were taken from her. But it seems like, nonetheless, Jesus, who had his family, you know, staged an intervention against him, Paul, who did, in fact, lose all of his friends, and they were threatening to murder him as well, they didn't seem stuck in that narrative. They continued on in the journey. Unforgiveness did not stop them. Or maybe we live in a fantasy of how our life will be better when we have more than we do now. The only thing wrong with our life now is that we don't have more, a desire for riches. And that clearly can keep us from being able to be present to what God's doing right here to continue on the journey. We're always living in this fantasy about what has to happen, and then the journey can start. That could choke things out too. But let's talk about why Satan is given such prominence. What about Satan is going to keep us from moving forward? Obviously, Satan sounds bad. The devil's probably many things. But here's how Matthew and John answer that question. They say that the key barrier to the kind of integrity, the wholeness we're looking for, that Satan stands against us in, is lies. Satan is all about lying. Satan is called the father of lies in John chapter 8, the same place where we're told by Jesus the truth is going to set us free. So if God the Father is in perfect integrity, perfect in that sense, we're told in the Sermon on the Mount, it's because the walls of God the Father's building are perfectly solid. They stand, etc. The wind blows through. Truth is all he's about. Lies are all Satan's about because the walls have all collapsed in Satan. So Satan has to manipulate us to get anything out of us because truth isn't going to be enough. So it's constant lying, constant lying, constant sense that truth doesn't even matter. And so truth will, lies will keep us from moving forward in the stages of the critical journey, from spiritual growth, from moving into sainthood, from moving into union with God, etc. So maybe this helps explain why the examen is such an ancient Christian practice. How we need to understand ongoingly the truth God is feeding into us to continue the journey. I think about a story in my own life. It's going to be about my father. My father's been dead for several years now. And let me start by saying my father's the best. I had a great relationship with my father. He was so supportive in the end of me and so kind of would leverage himself for me, completely benevolent towards me, my sister, my mom. My father's got a tremendous amount that I just so tremendously value. I'm going to say something about a hard moment, but I wanted that as the preamble. Here's the hard moment, though, and I think it's about why this truth and lies thing can either stop our progress or progress it. So one day I was out praying, and I remembered a dynamic that I had with my father. Let me give you some background and forgive traffic going by. One of the qualities of me broadcasting from the old garage office, I have pretty much no barrier in my urban environment to the outside world. So you may hear that every now and again. Back to my father. I realized that my father and I had a bad dynamic for a while. Here's the background. He had grown up in grinding poverty. He was on a subsistence farm, just wrenching poverty. And it sort of had to like forcibly eject himself from that setting and did, and found, you know, some real comfort in his later years. He was desperately afraid, I think, that I would have to face that horrible thing that I'd never had to face because he'd found enough comfort that I didn't grow up in grinding poverty. And his way out of that for me, and perhaps for my sister, was, but particularly for me, I think, that I would get good grades and go to a great school, and he found enough money that he felt proud of himself, I think, that he could pay for that great school, which he very much did, and that that would put me in a position where I'd be set up for life. You know, he wouldn't have to worry about me given the horrible things he'd had to go through. And that all worked great. I got good grades. I went to that good school. And then right about that point, I had this encounter with Jesus, and I started making different sorts of decisions. I moved and started, was part of a ministry in a high murder part of our area with kids to try to help them out. And then I started just kind of following the muse of God wherever God would take me. That was just brutally hard on my dad for reasons that I think are totally understandable. I think perhaps you'll get a feel for why that'd be so hard on someone like him. And the consequence of that was, I think it's fair to say for about 10 years, maybe more, 12, maybe even 15, there was, it feels like, at least my internal truth is, there was not a single conversation where he did not at one point tell me I was ruining my life because of this Jesus stuff. And just, I hadn't always ruining my life. Now, for a lot of that time, I think I would just try to talk him out of it. Dad, if you saw things from my point of view, I don't think that's true. And that didn't work. Because again, it was a very fundamental fear I think he was addressing, and that did not penetrate that fear. So I'm praying one day. It's been 10 plus years of this. And I suddenly think, I'm not living out my truth. I mean, I have a truth which I'm keeping under wraps because I'm afraid of losing the relationship. And I just think, I can't do that anymore. So I called him that day. And I said, Dad, hey, can I talk to you about something? As you know, I love you. I love being around you. You're a fun person to be there with. There's really very few people I'd rather hang out with than you. Except, you've probably noticed that for the last 10 plus years, there's rarely been a conversation, if ever been a conversation, which hasn't included a beat with you telling me I'm ruining my life. I think I can tell you without fear of contradiction, I can repeat back to you your points. I think in a way that you're going to agree, I get it. I'm tracking with your concerns. I've tried to answer it in various ways. It obviously hasn't gone very far. And so here's what I'm going to need from you to be able to have a relationship with you going forward. I need you never to bring that up again the rest of your life. That I get it. And if you have those stresses, you can share them with Mom. You can take them to God if you wanted. I wasn't quite in that space. But I can't do it anymore. And if it comes up in a phone conversation, I'm going to hang up. And if it comes up when I'm with you in person, I'm going to leave. And I will probably not call back, and I will probably not come back for a bit, just because I think I'll need a breather if that's the case. So that's where I'm at. Anyway, hope you're doing well. You can understand my dad was frustrated by that. We didn't talk for a few months, but then we ultimately did talk. And what do you know? Things got better. It was interesting. I was telling the story in some of our online small groups, and Grace, my wife, was hearing me tell the story and said, you know, it's funny you put it that way. I remember when you had that conversation. And looking back, I think I can say that while your parents were great and had a lot to offer, I always felt there was a certain superficiality, particularly from your dad, that I would just be in when we were together. And after that conversation, I felt like things got better and significantly better for me in that going forward. All to say, living one's truth, standing in integrity with the truth that you feel is true, seems to be an important part of moving forward, though threatening, is the only reason I bring up that story. So back to the critical journey. They say there that in the first three stages, that discovery of God, that group-oriented life of discipleship, and that productive life where who you are matters in the group, those first three stages, they say that our faith or our spirituality takes its expression most frequently in ways that are prescribed by external standards, whether by the church, a specific spiritual leader, a book, or a set of principles. In those first three stages, truth comes from the outside. We're told this is true, this is the way things are, and that's the nature of those stages. Then they say, but stages 4 through 6 represent a difficult personal transformation, but also a re-emerging that's going to require a rediscovery on a different level of what faith and spirituality are all about. It's like a, it's like remade, our faith and our spirituality gets remade in those four stages, and it comes from inside. They say these are inner healing stages, spiritually and psychologically, for which the journey can't be prescribed. Now, of course, the trick in that journey is that along with the three threats, Satan, unforgiveness, a desire for riches, the other thing which can keep it from happening is that we have an immature relationship with telling the truth. They can break down our integrity just as easily as they can build it up. To actually make this journey forward requires some maturing along the way. And if we can't do it, then that also, I suppose, can choke it out. So, for instance, our truth, say, might be how we've been victimized by people who've left us behind or whatever, as might, you could imagine, might be a challenge for my conversation partner. Now, feeling like I'm a victim, it could be totally true, but not helpful. That's where unforgiveness becomes so important. So what's the hope for my conversation partner? Let's say she does everything perfectly. The snares don't get her. She lives out her truth more and more, despite the tremendous losses she's experienced along the journey. If continuing to walk into the truth that God shows us along our journey is such a central part of our hope of this kind of saint-like sixth stage, union with God, what are practical things we might want to keep in mind along the way? Let me close with just a few of them. So perhaps we might practice the examine at least weekly. So the examine is kind of set up to be a daily practice, but at least weekly you're doing this ritual with God so that you are, in fact, in touch with how God is speaking through what is bringing you life and taking life from you. That's how your truth gets formed, we're told. So you'd practice the examine at least weekly. Then we might share your truths with at least one friend. So because you're not hiding, right? If you're not seen in your truths by anybody, then your walls still aren't standing quite as straight as they need to stand. So practice the examine at least weekly, perhaps. Share your truths with at least one friend. And then ask God for help to see whether you're unhelpfully keeping a key truth about yourself under wraps. You know, are you hiding? Because hiding is just not going to work in the second stage of the journey. Hiding is kind of part of the deal in the first three stages, but not in the second three parts of the journey. And then grieve whatever losses come along the way as you move forward with anticipation. Practice the exam at least weekly. Share your truths with at least one friend. Ask God for help to see whether you're unhelpfully keeping a key truth about yourself under wraps. And grieve whatever losses come along the way as you move forward with real anticipation of what's forward and in front of you in the journey. Again, Jesus tells us, what sets us free? The truth. Shakespeare, I suppose, exhorts us, to thine own self be true, as if it's so central. And that's a question we're all going to face. Does our truth matter in the settings we're in? Or is our truth just our problem? As we ongoingly grow in our life with God, I vote we choose to be seen. Thanks so much for joining me for this Pocket Contemplative. We'll talk again soon.